Yeah, so thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here and to see everyone, even if it's even virtually. And so I hope you enjoy this talk. So what I'm going to tell you about is that so this is this project that's shoot, I really should have put this in the opening slide. But it's joint work with Marcus Dierigel in Munich, Miguel Montero in at Harvard, and Jonathan Heckman in at Penn. So the thing I'm talking about today is on archive, and we're working on another project which will be out at some point. You know, we still have some stuff to figure out. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you about well I'm going to tell you about so type 2b has this duality symmetry, which is sort of like it's SL2z, except not quite, but I'll get there. And it turns out you could ask, well, does this symmetry have an anomaly? And surprise, it does. So what I'm going to tell you roughly in order, depending on how much time we have, I might go through certain sections faster, is first, okay, you know, what's the what's how do I actually think about anomalies in terms of invertible field theories, and how this turns into a question in algebraic topology. Then I'm going to focus specifically on the anomaly for that we're looking at today. I'll tell you a little bit about the computation, which was this really fun spectral sequence argument. And I know people don't usually say really fun and spectral sequence argument in the same sentence, but it's, I don't know. Well, anyways, my enthusiasm will be clear enough when we get there. Then there's this surprising result. You didn't need the spectral sequence argument to see this, but it points you in the right direction, that the anomaly is non-zero. This is kind of concerning. And then we had to find a way to cancel it. And so that's, you know, we don't have a complete definitive result about that, but we have a, you know, we have some, we have a thing that works on a bunch of the generators. So this is where we did need the Bohrism computation. And we have, you know, some evidence that suggests it'll work in general. So, okay, I'm realizing that probably people know the story, like a lot of people know the story of anomalies in vertical field theories. So if I'm, you know, if people are falling asleep, someone let me know and I'll move forward a little faster. But one thing I think that is, you know, if I've learned anything in grad school, it's that if you ask four people what anomalies in quantum field theory are, you'll get five different answers. Oh yeah, you know, you have this classical gauge symmetry that doesn't quite work in quantization. All right, there's this, I don't know, there's this, it's a polynomial built out of blah, 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 blah. You know, it's like, okay, well, I want to say that I'm at the boundary system of some bulk theory. It's like, there's so many different things. Maybe there's Feynman diagrams. So what I'm going to do is adopt this perspective that a quantum field theory is anomalous means that it's not defined absolutely. It's actually a boundary theory to something in one dimension higher, and that theory must be invertible. So in general, this is called a relative field theory by Fried and Telemann. So you know, you can if your QFT is topological, then Fried and Telemann have this formalism for it in their paper called Relative Quantum Field Theory. But in general, we're just you know, we don't have that formalism, so we're just thinking of this a little heuristically. So if you so I think about topological field theories from the perspective of Atiyah and Siegel, where there is a functor from the Bohrism category to some target. So I'm going to be very vague about this. You know, it should be Bohrisms with some structure. Maybe my manifolds have spin structure. Maybe my manifolds have a, you know, they have a principal bundle with a connection. So now your Bohrism category is geometric and like things get more interesting. So, like I said, I'm going to be agnostic about that. It's not going to really matter for this talk. And then C is whatever the target is. So maybe we're doing non-extended TFT and it's like vector spaces or super vector spaces. Maybe we're doing extended TFT and it's some higher category. You know, this is something that you know, we're not going to need to worry about today. So, but in any case, whenever you have the setup, you can ask what is it, you can ask what it means for a theory to be invertible. This definition is due to Dan Fried and Greg Moore from, I think, a 2004 paper on M theory. And so the idea is that because C is symmetric, so okay, let me review in terms of functions. You have functions from some set to the complex numbers. And you can take, given a function F, you can take 1 over F as long as F is never 0. As long as it's contained in the in, its image is the in, contained in the invertible complex numbers. And we're doing the same thing here. You have a function, which is a functor, and from some set to something with structure, you know, like the complex numbers are a field, C is a symmetric modal category. And so we're saying that the image of Z is contained in invertible stuff. So objects, for objects, invertibility means under tensor product. And for morphisms, higher morphisms, and so on, invertibility means under composition. So as a concrete example, you know, partition functions of these things are always non-zero. State spaces are always one dimensional because you, the tensor product is multiplicative. So the only way to tensor to the trivial vector space, the complex numbers, is to start with something that was already one dimensional. So from the perspective of quantum field theory, this is kind of silly, right? Like one dimensional state space, isn't that trivial? And so indeed, you should think of these things as field theories, which are almost trivial, but not quite. So many times that people study invertible field theories or invertible systems in mathematical physics, so for example, these SPT phases that we've heard a lot about in the last decade, a lot of times it's the perspective of this is the, you know, systems in general are complicated. We want to look at like the sort of the first non-trivial example that we can get our hands on and then study that and then later turn to the non-invertible case. And part of the reason that we might want to do this is that invertible field theories are classified. So there is a cobordism hypothesis for all topological field theories, but this is sort of a hard nonlinear thing. You need to know about N categories. And for invertible field theories, you just need to know about abelian groups. And this makes, I mean, okay, the abelian groups themselves maybe are a little bit tricky sometimes, but this makes the classification much nicer. It's linear. You can do linear algebra to learn things about invertible field theories. So this is this reflection positivity paper by Dan Fried and Mike Hopkins from about 5 years ago now. And so they classify unitary invertible field theories. So this if you don't want unitarity, then you can go back another 6 or 7 years to an older paper of Fried, Hopkins, Telemann. But I mean, the problem that I'm going to tell you about today is about type 2B string theory, which, you know, I don't know a lot about string theory, but I'm pretty sure that whatever it is, there's unitarity. So we want our anomaly theory to also have that unitarity. And so we want to use the Fried-Hopkins classification, which is actually simpler than the general case. So these things are classified by Anderson duals of Bordism spectra. If you know what that means, okay, but if you don't worry about it. The upshot is if you want to classify unitary invertible field theories, you should start by computing some Bordism groups. So Bordism, to say what the Bordism groups are, you need to say what kinds of manifolds am I considering? Do I care about oriented manifolds, spin manifolds, manifolds of the map to some space? So I'm going to call that a symmetry type and I'm going to call it H. And so it's whatever stuff you need to define like the fields of the theory, for example. So if you have fermionic fields, you probably need a spin structure of some sort. If you have a U1 gauge field, then you want to, you know, have a map to BU1, sorry, and so on. So I will say that, you know, when I said show, there's something like between the physics and the mathematics here. So they have a theorem for unitary invertible topological field theories. But you can also say, you can also ask, okay, well, let's say I have a geometric cobordism category. Could I come up with invertible field theories that are not topological? So classical Chern-Simons theory is a good example of this. And so their result is a conjecture in the non-topological case. Although I suspect it's the kind of conjecture that like once the definitions are in place, that it'll follow as a theorem. So as for actually computing this, so that you don't have to think about the word Anderson dual if you don't want to, there's this nice short exact sequence. So unitary invertible field theories are in the middle. Here I've specified the dimension n of the theory, and I've specified the specific type H of what kind of Bordism I care about, what kind of field theories I care about. So there's the subgroup on the left of invertible topological field theories. And what this is saying is that a unitary invertible topological field theory is determined by its partition function, which is a map from, which is a Bordism invariant valued in the non-zero complex numbers. So on the right-hand side, we have this like free part in one dimension higher. So if you're thinking about this as anomalies, the right-hand side is what you can see perturbative. It's the anomaly polynomial of the anomaly invertible field theory. And the left-hand side is the subtler torsion part that you can't see there. And so it's the one nice consequence of this Bordism classification is now we can revisit a bunch of old anomaly problems that with newer tools and get more precise results because we can see this torsion part.
Sorry, Arun, did you say that H was always like that at least H was going to be topological or?
I should have said that. Yes, so H is topological. Okay. Yeah.
So then thanks. Somehow the magic, then you're telling me some magic that like you're like, I might have worried about anomalies that were sort of really somehow just about the geometric structure that were really local to that.
Like, so. Okay, so I think that gets accounted for in this right hand side. So the if you have a, let's say you have an anomaly who's like, which is not in this subgroup. So it's like really not, it's an invertible non-topological field, like classical Chern size.
Right.
So the point is that this n plus one, this thing telling you the anomaly polynomial, it's like, if you have an n-dimensional quantum field theory, your anomaly polynomial is in degree n plus two. Right. And the invertible field theory is the secondary invariant associated to that.
Okay, and you're telling me that like, although I sort of, I naively wrote down some anomaly polynomial, it might've been, I might've like thought I had an anomaly for the geometric structure, but you're telling me I can remove it by just a local counter term exactly when this anomaly polynomial is zero?
I think so. Okay. Yeah, I think the thing I'm trying to say is that the anomaly polynomial, it's like a characteristic class, it looks topological, but we're taking a secondary invariant and therefore it really uses geometry.
Okay.
Oh yeah, and if the anomaly polynomial is non-zero, then yes, your anomaly field theory should be topological because it's in the left. And so I guess you'd have to use local counter. Great. Yeah, thank you for asking. Before I change the subject a little bit, like let me check. Are there more questions?
Sorry, if the anomaly polynomial is non-zero, then it should be topological, or if it's zero, it should be topological.
If it's zero. Right. Okay. So the right hand side is anomaly polynomials, and the left hand side is invertible topological field theories.
Yep.
So if the left, if you're zero on the right, then you're in the image of the left.
Cool. Thank
Great.
You.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for asking. More questions. Okay. So a couple notes about type 2B specifically. So first of all, you know, like I said, everyone thinks about anomalies differently. And so some people will think, okay, you know, there's this functorial field theory thing. What are you doing, Arun? You know, it's you know, space-time doesn't change, the topology of space-time doesn't change under, you know, under time evolution of a quantum field theory. So for these people, only mapping tori in the Bordism category are actually relevant because, you know, that corresponds to maybe some like diffeomorphism of space-time. And so that is a thing which matters. But you know, your Bordisms that like take space and, you know, chop it into two pieces, what's going on there? Like that does, maybe that doesn't say anything about the physics. But good news about type 2B, well, good news for the mathematicians, is that we care about, so this is some sort of supergravity theory. And so we're thinking, well, we should allow the topology of space-time to change. And these things are physically relevant in this supergravity theory. And so therefore, you know, we want to consider the entire Bordism category. And so we have access to this result of Fried and Hopkins. I mentioned, one, we discussed that there's this anomaly polynomial. So like there's the geometric part versus the purely topological part. And so there's this famous, you know, classic calculation of Alvarez Gomez and Witten, who showed that the anomaly polynomial of type 2B string theory vanishes. And so this tells us that our anomaly theory is purely topological. So we need to look only at the invertible topological field theories. And so this amounts to understanding this group of Bordism invariants. So from 11-dimensional Bordism, because we have a 10-dimensional theory, into C star. And so the thing which I have not told you is what is H. And so that's what's going to happen next.
Surely, by the way, even if you didn't care about gravity, you should still really look at the whole Bordism category as a way of like talking about local, like forcing the anomaly cancellation to be totally somehow local, right?
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I agree that this is the, but when if you talk to a large number of physicists, you get a large number of different opinions about what is and isn't actually correct.
Okay.
But no, I mean, I think that the functors are the, like, and Bordism category is the correct way to do this. But in any case here, because, you know, because it's a supergravity theory, this is like particularly unimpeachable. But yeah, good point. So what is the duality group of type 2B? You know, you start with this SL2R and then, you know, standard blah blah quantization, it's actually broken to SL2Z. So there's this recent paper of Shie, Tachikawa, and Yonakura. And so they point out that this is actually a little bit different. So they were interested in some other things, for example, the SL2Z anomaly of Maxwell theory in dimension four. But they also said they returned and said quite a bit about the general case, including type 2B string theory. So first of all, S inside SL2Z. You know, there's this presentation where S to the fourth is one. But if you actually look at how S acts on the objects on the fermions in 2B, the fourth power is not one. Instead, the fourth power is the fermion number. It's a little funny. And so the group you actually get there is what's called the metaplectic group, MP2Z. So this is the double cover of SL2Z. And inside that, So we're saying, okay, we have an MP2Z symmetry, and minus one in the metaplectic group is, you know, this fermion parity operator. And then U, meaning, okay, Shia Tachikawa and Yonakura, can also include this world sheet orientation reversal involution. So now we have, you know, we think of this as like a reflection. And so we, you know, if you did this for just SL2, you would get GL2. But also now we have this sort of spin-like cover, MP2Z. And so what we get is the pin plus double cover of GL2Z. And so I'm going to note this GL2 plus Z. So just to say again, GL2 plus Z doesn't mean orientation preserving matrices in GL2Z. This means, you know, like sometimes people might say that. This means the pin plus double cover. So, So GL2 plus Z is the symmetry group. So the strong way of realizing this symmetry is we want to couple to gauge fields for the symmetry, right? So because this is a discrete group, that just amounts to saying a principal GL2 plus bundle. So normally you would just say, okay, that's great. You know, I take that. That's a map to the classifying space, and I want to consider the spin boredism of BGL2 plus Z. But it turns out that our symmetry group mixes with fermion pairing, and that makes this slightly tricky. It's totally surmountable, but like it's a little more interesting. So I'm going to tell you the story. First, though, are there any questions? All right. I also can't see chat. So if there's questions in chat, please could someone please get my attention so I can look at them? Great, thanks. So before I tell you what this is for GL2 plus Z, I'm going to give you a simple example that you may have already seen. And if you haven't, at least it's less complicated than the case that I'm going to tell you about. So let's say that I had a symmetry by the group spin 2. So you know spin 2. It's SO2, it's U1, it's the circle group. But I'm going to call it spin 2 because I want to think about its quotient by 2, by minus 1. So let's say I have a spin 2 symmetry acting on a quantum field theory, and minus 1 in spin 2, you know, the kernel of the map to SO2 acts by the fermion parity operator. So that's similar to what we have. You know, we have a minus 1 equals minus 1 to the F, but a different group. So it turns out that you could say I consider spin manifolds the principal spin 2 bundle, but you can also work a little more generally. You could say, well, let's look at manifolds which aren't quite spin and which don't quite have a principal spin 2 bundle, but the problem is a minus 1 in both cases. And because I've identified minus 1 in spin 2 with minus 1 df, then the obstructions to actually making these real, they cancel out British structure. And the problems with making it a spin structure and the problems with making it a spin 2 bundle are like in the same places. And so it turns out that you could couple, like, you can make sense of your theory with its symmetry on manifolds with this structure. So the transition functions are not valued in spin n cross spin 2. You know, the transition functions for the data, the tangent bundle and your principal spin 2 bundle. But instead, spin n times spin 2 modulo this common plus minus 1 subgroup. So we're saying, okay, minus 1 in spin 2 is minus 1 to the f here. We're identifying those two. And we get a group that is commonly known as spin n c. And so the point is, you can put your theory on spin C manifolds. And so all the stuff, the game that you might want to play, studying anomalies, you know, calculating partition functions, whatever, you can do it even if your manifold is spin C but not spin. So we're going to do something very similar for the duality symmetry. So let's see. Does this thing make sense? Like this what we're going to do? Okay. So the first thing, I'm going to say it for MP2Z first, because maybe you care about things that, like, maybe you don't care about world sheet orientation reversal, and then you can throw it in later. And also in practice, the way that we did the computation was we first did it for MP2Z and then used that to learn about GL2 plus Z. So I'm going to call it a spin MP2Z structure. So this is saying that the transition functions for the tangent bundle are valued in not spin n cross SL2Z, but in this mixed version. So spin and then the metaplectic group, and then we identify the common plus minus one. So just like forming spin C, but now we have the metaplectic group instead of spin two. So these things do not necessarily have spin structures, and they do not necessarily have metaplectic group bundles, but the obstructions cancel each other out. So you could also think about this as like your frame bundle lifts from an ON bundle to a spin N crossover plus minus one MP2Z bundle, but you know, or you could think about it as transition functions. So we don't have a metaplectic group bundle, but we do have a bundle for metaplectic group modulo that common plus minus one. And that's an SL2Z bundle. So on a spin MP2Z manifold, you have an SL2Z bundle, you have an orientation, and the characteristic class is obstructing you to lift to a spin structure or to an MP2Z bundle. Those two characteristic classes are identified. So this is very similar to if you have a spin C structure, you have an orientation, you have a spin 2 mod plus minus 1 bundle, an SO2 bundle, which is called the determinate bundle. Often we think of it as a complex line bundle because SO2 is U1. And it turns out that W2 of that determinate bundle equals W2 of your manifold. So this analogy has sort of been the guiding light that carried me through this, and hopefully it will for you too. So, you know, not quite spin, not quite MP2, but the problems are cancel each other out. And so you could do exactly the same thing with spin GL2 plus. You lift to this group where you mix spin and GL2 plus, and manifolds that are spin GL2 plus have an associated GL2Z bundle, because that's GL2 plus mod plus minus one. So one thing which is worth pointing out is that spin MP2 manifolds are always spin C, but spin GL2 plus manifolds are not. So this will come up later. So, you know, with that foreshadowing in mind, it's not major, but I'll say it again. But it's just an interesting, like, here's a little geography of what's going on. So to summarize,
the world shape parity, I guess, is just local. Like, that's not acting by like minus by time reversing symmetry or something.
No. So that's actually something which is interesting, which is that these things are oriented. And I think that's related to the thing you just told me.
I mean, I was just re-saying what you had said in words I understood.
Okay, great.
And okay.
No, were you going to say more?
Well, if you had asked me, like, if you would just describe to me GL2 plus abstractly and ask me what's the most natural type of manifolds that I could put this on, I would have thought that you would use you would have done something with orientation reversing symmetries, but you weren't.
Yeah, this was actually interesting. This was something that I was confused about too at first. So actually, if you put R instead of Z, then this thing, GL2 plus R is homotopy equivalent to O2. And so you look at like spin O2 manifolds. And you're right, the most natural thing to look at is, so this is one of the 10 Fried-Hopkins symmetry types, this like Altman-Zernbauer way. And so it's called pin tilt twiddle C plus. And so this is not necessarily oriented, in fact, generally isn't. And like, it's sort of the first thing you would think to do with if you have spin and O2 mix it. But this is a different thing. And there's a notion of spin O2, which is not, you know, which is different. It induces an orientation, and this is sort of a discrete version.
Okay.
So here's just a little fun fact that I like, is that if you, there was this paper last month by Luke Stiehauer called Interacting SVT Phases Are Not Morita Invariant. And so he computed about symbordism groups for this spin GL2 plus R, just for a completely different reason. And again, you know, you need the oriented type, but it's kind of funny that you, like you said, it looks like it should be unoriented, but it's not. So now we know what H is. We want to consider bordism of spin MP2Z and spin GL2 plus C. And so that's what we're going to do. One thing which I did want to mention is, and this, you know, I don't know the first thing about F theory. So of course, this thing was told to me by my collaborators, Marcus, Jonathan, and Miguel. But a lot of what's going on here is secretly from the point of view of F theory. So a spin metaplectic group manifold has a canonical torus bundle. So the idea is that you have your determinant SL2Z bundle, so to speak, and SL2Z acts on the torus, fixing a base point. So you can form this mixing construction and get a torus bundle. So this is a bundle. This is a bundle of elliptic curves. And so I guess you can think of this as like an F theory. This is how you go from type 2B to F theory. So a spin MP2 structure is equivalent to this torus bundle and a spin structure on the total space, which is what you wanted in F theory. Except maybe you say, you know, elliptic curve bundle of elliptic curves, I actually wanted an elliptic vibration, but that's, I'm not going to worry about that right now, because that would make the math problem much harder, and I don't really know how to do it. And similarly, a spin GL2 plus structure is saying, I want a pin plus structure on the total space of my torus bundle. And this pin plus is related to the fact that M theory makes sense on pin plus manifolds. So now, So that was just a cool look behind a curtain. So now let's get to some bordism. Let's do some computations. So this anomaly invertible field theory is topological. So as I mentioned, it's determined by its partition function, which is a Bordism invariant of this sort. So now there is an abelian group of these finitely generated. We're going to figure out what it is, figure out generators. So in principle, once we have that, there is this formula told to us by the field content of 2B, which tells us how to calculate the anomaly on any particular manifold. There's some eta invariants of the fermions. There's a self-dual part. Great. But we need to know which, in order to determine the anomaly theory, we need to know which manifolds are the generator. Like, you know, there's lots and lots of Lembit manifolds with spin GL2 plus structures. And we need to know which ones are the keys to tell us what the anomaly theory is. And so this will be most useful when we want to cancel, because then we can say, okay, well, we know that the anomaly is only this bad. There's no other manifolds out there that it could be that could be hiding that make it worse. So here's the answer. This Bordism group, there's a Z mod 27, there's a Z mod 8, there's a Z mod 3, and then there's 9 factors of Z mod 2. So let me tell you what the generators are, because that's probably a little more meaningful. So the two longest summands are generated by Lens spaces. So Z mod 27 is a Lens space S11 mod Z3. Z mod 8 is S11 mod Z4. There's more than one Lens space in this dimension, even when you specify the group. But you know, there's one, there is a particular one that gives you this. And they're detected by eta invariants. So now, I told you that the fact that spin GL2 plus manifolds are not spin C, it's going to come back. So this is like technical annoying point that I think people care about more on the mathematical side than on the physics side. So in order to detect with an eta invariant, this eta invariant needs to be a Bordism invariant canonically defined on spin GL2 plus manifolds. And spin GL2 plus does not, like, there are explicit examples, I'll tell you one in just a moment, that are not spin C. So how do you define eta invariants when you don't have at least some sort of spin or spin C structure? And so the answer is, you use twisted eta invariants. And so this is, I don't know, it's both more annoying and less annoying than it sounds, and that like actually working through the details is like, I've stressed, like confusing and like a little bit painful. But in practice, for the eta invariants that we need, you know, you can use sort of like, it just sort of follows from the spin MP2 case that everything just works. And so, you know, there's sort of an interesting mathematical question here about twisted K theory, but we don't have to worry too much about it. The next two summands, a Z3 and then one of the 9 Z2s, they're detected by HP2 times some Lens spaces. So peering behind the curtain, spin Bordism, you know, there's one summand and then another thing beginning in dimension 8, and that's HP2 times stuff. And so these are three-dimensional Lens spaces. And so again, these are detected by eta invariants with the same caveat that's not actually a problem. Now the remaining Z2 summands. So first of all, there's RP11, which is nice. There's HP2 cross RP3, also fine. Spin Bordism in dimension 10 is Z2 plus Z2 plus Z2. And two of the Z2s are like HP2 cross something, or like they're things that are standard. HP2 cross a torus, the Bott manifold cross a torus. And then there's this third one that I think Milner might've discovered, which is some closed spin 10 manifold with this particular characteristic class condition. And so each of these, like you're asking, okay, 1, 2, 3, you're asking for 8 summands. And I've told you 4, you know, these three and then the Arcanum, which I'll say in a bit. So it, what actually ends up happening is that these each canonically have two distinct non-bordant spin GL2 plus structures. So it turns out the anomaly is the same on those two structures, but they give you additional summands in the Bordism group. So we've just seen 6 of them, RP11 and its brother, HP2 cross RP3 and its brother, X10 cross X1 and its brother. And then the last two are this weird manifold that we had trouble, it took us a while to find, and which I think Jonathan decided to call Arcanum 11. So this is the one. This manifold is not, it's an RP5 bundle over RP6. It is orientable, but not spin C. And it, calculating the stuff that, like calculating stuff on it is kind of tricky, but it satisfies the correct characteristic class condition to be the last generator, or sorry, the last two generators. There's this thing, and then it's, you know, the two different structures it has. Before I go on, are there any questions? Okay. So these are our generators. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about the computations. As you're probably already aware, I am an algebraic topologist who doesn't know a lot about string theory. So my major contribution to this project was doing the computation. And then we all worked on all parts of it. I did not do the computation alone, and it would have taken me much longer if Miguel, Marcus, and Jonathan were not there, especially solving some of the extension problems. But, you know, I did more of the work on the computation and a lot less of the work on the string theoretic consequences. So I'm because of that, I am giving the talk, and it's going to be more about the computation. Whereas, for example, if you were at the conference where Miguel talked about it 2 weeks ago, he said a lot more about the string theory implications. So what are we going to do? There's the standard thing in homotopy theory where you work one prime at a time. And so you say, I don't need homotopy equivalences. I allow maps which are bad. They don't induce isomorphisms in homology or generalized homology, but they do tell they preserve all of the two torsion or the four five torsion or whatever. So if you allow that, then you can you're more flexible. So GL2 plus Z factors as an amalgamated product of dihedral groups in a way that makes it simplify very, very well if you work one prime at a time. So this is reminiscent of the fact that SL2Z is Z4 amalgamated over Z2 with Z6. And so this is a really nice thing. If you're an algebraic topologist, SL2Z behaves like a finite group. You know, its cohomology is exactly like that of a finite group. Its generalized cohomology, same. So for example, if you're working at the prime two, then Z3 is trivial at the prime two. So this amalgamated product is the same as Z4 amalgamated over Z2 with Z2. And so, you know, the amalgamations go away. And so at P equals two, you can't tell apart BSL2Z and BZ4. And so, for example, if you want to compute the spin bordism of BSL2Z, well, the spin bordism of BZ mod four is already known. So at the prime two, you're done. And so with GL2 plus, well, it was a little more complicated, but a similar story works. And like, allows us to go from this thing, which feels like it's like way too complicated, to something which is much simpler. And so using the amalgamation, you can deduce that this bordism group, first of all, the bordism group in dimension 11, it's torsion, that much is relatively clear. And then there's a straightforward argument for showing that. And then moreover, it only contains two and three torsion. And so that way you can, means there's only two things to look at. So I'm going to tell you the story at the prime three first, where it's easier. And so the amalgamation tells you that there's the group D6, including into GL2 plus Z, you know, as automorphism of the triangle. This tells you that this map is an isomorphism on three torsion. We just need to compute the spin bordism of this classifying space. So this has not been done in the literature before, but it's not that hard. So the standard tool to do this is called the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence. You lay out the homology of the dihedral group and the spin bordism of a point, and that's your E2 page. And then, you know, there could be differentials. So slight lie, I didn't use the spin bordism of Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence. At an odd prime, spin bordism is equivalent to a sum of simpler pieces, which are called Brown-Peterson homology. And so this means that there's like less stuff in your spectral sequence, which means that there's less room for it to be hard. And, you know, it's sparser. And so what we actually did was we ran the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence for Brown-Peterson homology. And so this is not that hard. You know, there is not room for differentials. And then there's an extension question, but the extension question turned out to be like not that bad. So that's how I had a Z27 rather than three Z3s. And so this one is like, you know, it was fairly straightforward. I can tell you more about that if people want, but the two primary stories are interesting. So then digression. This is just something I think is cool. So the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence for spin bordism, you can combine it with the Sayre spectral sequence for a fibration, right? You know, the cohomology of the base with coefficients of the cohomology of the Schlüter space. And so you have, it's like, you know, it's like, it's been a while since I watched the Transformers movies, but I think I seem to recall there's a scene where like two of them combine into this bigger, more powerful transformer, right? And so you get this Lorentz-Sayre Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence. I should probably put more names on here, maybe Grothendieck. But it combines, you know, you have the Sayre spectral sequence for a fibration with the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence computing generalized cohomology. And so you start with the cohomology of BZ2 with coefficients in the bordism of BZ3. This is known. And then it converges to the spin bordism of BD6. And again, in practice, you use Brown-Peterson homology. And so it's an argument of about the same length, but honestly, I think the spectral sequence is cool and underrated, and I'm glad I got a chance to bust it out, even though you don't need it. So digression aside, any questions before we go on to the two primary case?
I think Atiyah and Herzberg say that their spectral sequence was known to Sarah and Whitehead.
Yes. Yeah. So they attribute it to Whitehead. And I think someone else around the same time pointed out that like it was essentially a corollary of a thing in like maybe Carton Eilenberg's book. In any case, it's called the Atiyah Herzberg spectral sequence. And so, yeah, it's what? It's the Arnold principle named by someone else, like that things are not named after their creators. If there aren't any other questions right now, I'll go on to the two primary story. This one's a lot more involved and was harder. So now what we need, so if you run the amalgamation story, again, it simplifies. There's a finite group now. And we get another thing. It's sort of like spin C, but instead of GL2 plus, we have this dihedral group D16. And so we identify minus one, so a half turn in the dihedral group with minus one of the F and spin. And so the plan is, what we want to do, there are lots of tools for computing spin borders. There's lots of papers that do this, especially in the recent physics literature. So if we can re-express spin D16 bordism, so this complicated thing, as the spin bordism of a thingy, then we can throw these techniques at. And so the specific technique I want to use is the atom spectral sequence. The atom spectral sequence has a reputation in homotopy theory, but this is a lot less crazy than it sounds. So this is something I find remarkable personally. So atoms for spin bordism at the prime two is dramatically simpler than the general case. And so this was discovered in the 70s, first used in the thesis of Don Davis. And it's like, I think people regarded it mostly as a toy model. You know, you play with this like, you know, spectral sequence for spin bordism and like blah, blah, blah. Okay, it's cute. You know, G.M. Bovell has a couple papers where he does cool stuff with it. But like the real prize is like the harder, more fully general. But then it turns out, you know, who needs to compute a lot of spin bordism groups? Physicists. And so all of a sudden, this toy model that's like much simpler than the general case, but still difficult enough to be a little interesting, is showing up in like these physics papers. And this is this remarkable thing that if you had told me about this my first year of grad school, I would never believe it. Spectral sequences are abstract nonsense. And it's really, I'm really happy to see that it's showing up, like crossing the bridge. And so, okay, maybe you're thinking, well, we have this Atiyah Herzberg thing, it's quite nice. Why bust out something more complicated? And the answer is that the atom spectral sequence has a lot more structure. This is part of what makes it harder, but the structure forces a lot of differentials and extension problems for you. And this means that it's easier to sort of, if you have a simple, like a toy model kind of atom, like if you're in a situation where it's easy to set up and run, then those constraints tell you extension problems more easily than a tier, like more easily than a tier Herzberg would. And so that's the thing that we used. Okay, I didn't say it yet. But first, we need to get to spin bordism of something. So spin D16 bordism is a certain kind of twisted spin bordism. So the formalism is, if I have a vector bundle over a space X, we can define an XV twisted spin structure. And so what that is on a different vector bundle, is it's a map to X and a spin structure on your vector bundle plus the pullback of V. So for example, pin minus structures. So a pin minus structure on E is equivalent to a spin structure on E plus det E. And so this is equivalent to a twisted spin structure for the tautological bundle over BO1. You take E plus some line bundle, and you ask for a spin structure on that. Now, why does that work? Because as soon as you've asked for that to be oriented, then the line bundle has to be the determinant bundle. Or the determinant bundle dual, but because these are real vector bundles, that's the same. Up to a contractible choice of metrics, blah, blah, blah. So in other words, pin minus structures, so maybe something we don't know super well, are, you know, they're not quite spin structures, but they're twisted. And there's different ways of doing this. You know, Dan Fried and Mike Hopkins in their reflection positivity paper, they express twist, you know, these like, for example, this pin tilde C plus thing that I mentioned earlier, they compute this as spin bordism of something, but their argument is much more homotopical. I like this twisted spin structure formalism because, I mean, you have to prove like a lemma, which you know, is a little bit of stuff. But then after that, showing like, this is relatively concrete. And you could, and actually proving that pin structures are equivalent to these twisted spin structures, this is a group theoretic argument. Like you mess around with the Lie group pin n minus. And I think if I had to guess for the, you know, an audience that cares about type 2B string theory and like in general mathematical physicists would and physical mathematicians would rather mess around with like Lie groups than with abstract homotopy theory arguments. So we would like to express spin D16 bordism as some sort of twisted spin bordism. So the one homotopical lemma I mentioned is once you is that XV twisted spin Bordism is isomorphic to the spin Bordism of this thing called a Tom spectrum. So if you know what a spectrum is, then okay, this is a particularly nice example. If you don't, then you can imagine that this is a pointed topological space, and everything I say will still make sense, even if it's like slightly false. So the upshot, it's some object that we can do homotopy theory with, and is slightly more general and is useful in this case. But the upshot is once you do the Lie group theory argument that your structure is a twisted spin structure, then you have a blueprint for doing the computation. That's sort of the real takeaway of the slide. Here is how to get from a complicated mixed symmetry type to something that you can work with.
Cool.
Yeah. What's up?
Okay, maybe you're about to tell me how this works out, but it's going to be something like: is the content of the algorithm that I kind of want X to be whatever D16 mod Z2, and I want to find a vector bundle over that with prescribed characteristic classes?
Precisely it. Good.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't say it in that language, but that's basically it. So in this case, the bundle has to have, so W1 has to be trivial and W2 has to be the bundle of the characteristic class of the standard representation of the D16. Or actually, well, D16 mod Z2, which is D8. But yeah, that's precisely it. Great. Good. Are like any further questions or more on that question or any other? Okay. So, and then okay, well, sure enough. So here is a representation which has the correct characteristic classes. It's orientable, and W2 is what you need it to be. You know, the standard representation. W2 the standard representation. And so, you know, we want this to be orientable because that way a blah, you know, blah 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 twisted spin structure induces an orientation. So this fact, how do you actually do it? Again, it's really, you write down this Lie group, spin n cross D16 mod the common plus minus one. And you factor that as a pullback of some stuff. And then you get that, and then you use that to say, okay, well, a map to that is a map to, you know, these things satisfying this thing. It's really like playing around with Lie groups. It's, you know, out of all the crazy, you know, there's a lot of fancy mathematics in here, and this stuff is like pretty concrete. And so what we need to do is, you know, all we need to do is understand the spin Bordism of this Tom spectrum. So the Tom spectrum, D16 mod Z2, as Theo pointed out, take the classifying space, take this vector bundle that we use to twist. And then this minus five, you should not worry about. This is there so that the Tom isomorphism has degree zero. And if you don't know what that means, then you can pretend that I never said it. And if you don't know what it means, well, it's so that the Tom isomorphism has degree zero.
So can I ask if I just had some random spin G, am I guaranteed to always be able to do this? Or can there be classes that aren't characteristic classes? I know in high enough degree, there are classes which are not characteristic classes. And I could like fail to be able to apply this procedure.
Yes. So the problem is, are W1 and W2 always, do they always come from a vector bundle?
Yeah.
And so I think the answer is in general, no. There's this is... So this comes up in a different context in like Kreck's work on like modified surgery theory and like classifying manifolds up to stable diffeomorphism, which is a different Bordism problem. And so the way that these arguments seem to go is that in a lot of in most cases you might consider this is fine. Like there's a vector bundle, life works. But a priori, I think there are examples where it's not true. So if you wanted to really make a headache for yourself, you could probably do it in the general case, like the universal case where you work with like, you know, KZ21 cross KZ22, and then like, you know, there's not a vector bundle there in general. So in that case, I don't know what you would do. Like every time I've needed to look at it, there's been a vector bundle. Probably you could still press forward. There's other ways of thinking about this. I just like the twisted spin formalism. But yeah, great question.
Well, it gives you computational access.
But there should still be a way to compute in the general setting. I just would have to find a different way forward. Yeah. So we have our object X we want to keep it spin Bordism of. Anderson, Brown, and Peterson in their seminal work from, 50 years ago now, show that at the prime two, spin Bordism splits into a direct sum of simpler homology theories. So up to dimension 11, there's three sumands we care about. There's connective K-theory, KO, there's connective K theory, this minus 10 should be a star minus 8. I'm sorry about that. So connective K theory, but starting again in degree 8. And then this thing called KOJ. So it's the connective K theory of the Joker spectrum smash X, if that is anything useful to you. But if not, all you need to know about is it's a variant of KO. In dimensions 11 and below, it coincides, like this thing is just mod 2 homology in dimension star minus 10. So you can basically forget about this. It's not that hard, unless you really care about things past dimension 11, in which case it's also not that hard, but like it's a little harder. And so basically all we need to do is compute the connective K theory of our Tom spectrum X. And this is where the atom spectral sequence simplification kicks in. The cohomology of KO, Stong computed it and showed that it has this nice formula, which means that the atom spectral sequence is, so a priori it's X'd over the entire Steenrod algebra. The Steenrod algebra is infinitely generated, non-commutative, and totally a headache. But for KO theory, we just get A1, which is an eight-dimensional thing with two generators, square one and square two. And so all these calculations, you can do them by hand. Maybe you shouldn't because we have computers, but like you can really run through the whole stuff. You can do everything by hand. You can check it by hand. It's like, and like someone like me can do this spectral sequence computation. And that's, you know, it's such a nice thing that this toy model, which is fun and tractable to calculate, can be used to say useful things. That's something that I find really remarkable. Also, there's a slight caveat here. This is only at the prime two. So like, you know, if you care about free torsion, you're not going to see it here, but we had, you know, we already dealt with that. So here's the outline. First, you compute the A1 module structure on the cohomology of this Tom spectrum. This is routine. You can do it by hand. You can, we used a computer to make it go faster. So if you want to know how to do this, I'm happy to talk about it. To anyone, send me an email. There's this paper by Agnès Baudry and Jonathan Campbell that explains a lot of it. Then compute the X of this module. So usually this is kind of annoying, but when I say compute, I mean, open up that paper I just mentioned, you know, find the sumands that we found in here and look up their X groups and then just put that in your spectral sequence. Like if you need to compute X of an A1 module, probably you don't have to do any computations. You can just look for it in the literature. And again, that's something I'm always happy to talk to people about. If you do need to do computations, there are ways, but like you don't have to do that usually. Just you look it up. And then you have to compute differentials. So this is not so easy. This is typically the hardest part of the atom spectral sequence. Like people will write entire theorems to prove entire theorems and write entire papers to resolve single differentials. But we are not in the hard case. We are in the easy case. And so the differentials were not all trivial, but standard tools eliminate a lot of them. Specifically, Margolis's theorem for differentials coming out of free sumands, the May-Milgram theorem for differentials between spikes. And then there were a couple more left that we had to deal with that were like a little bit funny, but hey, you know, they weren't so bad. And the reason is that the atom spectral sequence has an enormous amount of structure, and this structure severely constrains what differentials are possible. And then you only have a couple left and you can sort of pick them off individually. A big part of this is the fact that we only care up to dimension 11. If you care up to dimension like 5 or so, like, you know, the typical condensed matter papers, there's often just no differentials at all. And so for us, you know, we were a little less fortunate and we had to deal with a few, but we were able to pick them off. It's like, again, mostly standard arguments. And finally, once you get to the infinity page, there can be extension problems. The structure in the atom spectral sequence gives you a lot of, it gives you tools for solving most of those extension problems. There were also a few extensions left. And here's where I specifically want to shout out my collaborators for finding a solution to these extension problems that I had never thought of. So they were like, well, we can just compute eta invariants of Lens spaces and see what we get. And sure enough, that just solved all these problems. And it would have taken me much longer to do that. So the point is mostly easy. There were a few speed bumps, but thanks to my wonderful collaborators, they were not very big speed bumps. So the first step was compute the cohomology. Here's a picture of much of it. So the rule is, so the y-axis is the degree, and a vertical line indicates square one of the lower class is the upper class. So I mentioned the generators, and then you can compute square one and square two using characteristic classes of the vector bundle. And square two is all the curvy lines. So whether they curve to the left or the right or to the center. So you'll notice there are these seven very rainbow colored sumands. So the idea is a priori, this is just some mess, but it splits into these sumands, which are small and easy to analyze. There's also, so this is, there's a couple things that I'm neglecting, which is there are also 12 free sumands, you know, isomorphic to A1, which I'm not showing here simply because there's no room. They are sort of the easiest thing to deal with in the spectral sequence. So that's not what I want to focus on. Moreover, this picture is only complete, you know, this picture and the missing free summands is only complete up to dimension 12. After that, there's more stuff. But hey, you know, we care about something in dimension 11, so we're just going to not worry about that. So that's the first picture. The colors are going to carry through. So red corresponds to red in the next picture, green corresponds to green in the next picture, and so on. Before I go on, any questions about this?
Is there any content in the horizontal spacing other than making it readable?
No. Good question, though. So you say, okay, so all of these things, their X has been known for years. You can look it up and you get this E2 page. The black dots come from the free sum ends that I didn't show you. So this looks kind of messy, but most of the differentials are between towers, which means that the May-Milgram theorem can kill them for you in terms of box gene information, or from free sum ends, like things coming from free sum ends, which Margolis' theorem tells you the answer to. So honestly, it's not so bad. And it was helped even more by the fact that we did spin MP2 before this, which allowed us to, which maps to this and tells you a lot of information about the spectral sequence. So, okay, something, something, something. Here's the E infinity page. It's much cleaner. So you'll notice these free sum ends in dimensions 4 mod n. There's some extension problems. So for example, these three dots in dimension 11 come together in the Z8. And then here's four of the eight Z2s, four of the nine Z2 sum ends. There's some more coming from other things. You know, because we didn't just have KO, we had some other stuff. So I'll just mention that part two of the product is we're studying the McNamara-Vafa cobordism conjecture for type 2b. And so we need to know the generators of Bordism groups in all of the dimensions. And we've got that except for this dot, this dot, this dot. And then we have an idea for this that we're still figuring out. And once we have that, then we'll be able to run the whole, like study, say what that corresponds to in string theory. So there's just a lot of interesting structure here. And it, you know, it's, I don't know, it's fun. So before I go on, any questions about the spectral sequence stuff? I'm also cognizant of time, and I'm going to try and finish close to on time. Okay, so this is, I'm going to soapbox for a moment, which is that these Adams calculations over A1 are usually pretty routine. And even the harder questions, so string Bordism or TMF, these you can use A2 instead of A1 at the prime 2. Honestly, in low dimensions, they're still fairly straightforward. You have these pretty strong structural constraints, especially in low dimensions. And so you can just do these things. And there are a lot of physics problems out there which might have interesting answers that like that come down to Bordism. So it's not just this. So like I mentioned the McNamara-Vafa cobordism conjecture. You know, we're working on 2B, but you could also do like the heterotic strings, you know, E8 cross E8 and SO32. You could do type 1. These involve string Bordism or twisted string Bordism. And so you get more interesting Bordism computations, more elaborate, but like still very tractable. So there's just lots of cool stuff out there to do that would be interesting to work on. Like there's just, it seems like there's this lots of other opportunities. So I like these computations and I hope to get to do some more of them, but there's lots of interesting stuff out there. And so there's good things to find. So back to the anomaly, I'm gonna go kind of quickly. Okay, so the anomaly comes from, if you actually wanna compute it, it's eta invariants of Dirac operators that I mentioned that are twisted. And there's a term coming from the C field. So the C field is self-dual. And so the anomaly has only been worked out recently by Samuel Monnier, and then also some stuff in this paper of Shie Tachikawa Yonakura. And so this is sort of the thing that we couldn't have done 10 years ago that makes it that is why this paper happened in 2021. So this is something I want to mention because it's a thing that we don't know. So first of all, the field strength is a twisted differential cocycle. So it's in H6 and it's in the integer cohomology where reflections in GL2 act by -1. So this is our GL2 plus mod Z2 bundle. So it's GL2. So on spin MP2 manifolds, you can forget about the twist. So this thing has a torsion bilinear pairing. So this is usually if you have an odd dimensional manifold, you can go immediately above the middle dimension, which would be 5.5. So we look at 6, and there's a torsion pairing from torsion classes there into R mod Z. So this is like the linking pairing on a 3 manifold. And we're in twisted cohomology. But the tensor product of two copies of L untwists, so we can still define this torsion pairing. So part of the data needed to define this anomaly is a quadratic refinement of the torsion pairing. So we have a bilinear form, and we turn it into, and we pick a quadratic refinement. So here we have to make an assumption, and I bolded this because it's important that there is a. So we assume that there is a canonical quadratic refinement on a spin GL2 plus Z11 manifold, similar to how, for example, on a spin manifold in dimension 2. The intersection pairing is a quadratic refinement. This is different because it's the torsion pairing and it's twisted, but we're assuming this. We did not prove it. physically it's justified by M theory, F theory duality, because in M theory, if you extend to pin plus manifolds, or if you do MC to take into account the four form, you don't need to supply a quadratic refinement there. So we think that this should be true. It would be concerning if it weren't true, but we didn't prove it. And so maybe the answer is that we should pass to K theory, where like, you know, these things really in string theory ought to be K theoretic. But mixing K theory and the duality symmetry is like, you know, this seems to be a very hard problem. So we decided not to do that this time. So I just want to make clear this, we assume that the quadratic refinement exists, and we did not, we're not saying anything about like a theorem about that. So once you have that, then Chiatachi Kawa Yonakura wrote it down. You have an eta invariant, which is fine. You have the arf invariant of the quadratic refinement, and you evaluate the quadratic refinement on the field strength of the Seltu field. And so that lands in R mod Z, which gives us our exponentiate to give us our C star valued Bortism invariant. So so I just wanted to mention that is a thing which, you know, needs to be figured out. So then we calculated the anomaly mostly. So I will point out that on this, so this thing is a Lens space bundle. Oh shoot, okay, that means I made a typo in a previous slide, that this Z8 is generated by a Lens space bundle over S2, not a Lens space. So we were able to figure out the anomaly only partly on this thing, which is related to difficulties of computing eta invariants. We were able to figure it out everywhere except for these arcana manifolds, where we don't understand the eta invariants on this thing or the intersection, the torsion pairing on this well enough either. So you'll notice the anomaly is non-trivial. A is the anomaly. So okay, these were the caveats. We were not able to completely determine the anomaly because there are some difficulties of computing eta invariants on Lens space bundles and on studying the intersection pairing. What I did want to highlight is the quadratic refinement means that we had to work around our assumption. And so the trick to do that is that if you say trivial duality bundle, then the anomaly is a Bortism invariant from 11-dimensional spin Bortism, which vanishes. And so this trick means that on generators which are spin, we can just compute the quadratic refinement using the anomaly coming from the self-dual field and quadratic refinement in this way. So that trick helps. But in general, you know, not all the generators are spin or even spin C. So that's part of the reason that there was this ambiguity in some of these manifolds. So this leaves some questions left. The first is there a canonical choice of quadratic refinement? This would be a trivialization of some sort of Wu class. So that's, you know, a thing to figure out. And then figuring out the eta invariance of the remaining manifolds that we weren't able to do. Finally, there's a large number of additional fields, symmetries, et cetera, that we could consider, even higher form symmetries. And it's like, okay, well, what happens if you care about those? Do they mix? Is there a mixed anomaly? So the question gets richer and harder. Okay, so I am not going to go into the detail of canceling the anomaly because of time. Maybe I'll say like one or two sentences, but first are there any questions about what just happened? Okay, so, you know, light speed, talking about canceling the anomaly. So the big thing is, so here's where, when Miguel gives these talks, he says, okay, you know, we have just shown that 2B is inconsistent, F theory is wrong, anyways, end of the talk. And then he pauses for just long enough for it to be funny and then says, no, just kidding, we were able to cancel it. This anomaly is a problem that we need to fix because we want, like, that's, it's not always true. Sometimes anomalies are fine, but if we want type 2B to really be consistent, we better cancel it. And so the gist of it is we want to compute you can modify the usual Trin-Simons term, and it cancels the anomaly at everywhere we compute. It works on all the spin MP2 plus generators that were above the dotted line. For spin GL2 plus manifolds, you know, we don't know everything about X11, this Arcanum manifold, this RP5 bundle over RP6, but otherwise it's fine. So you add a term, there's a Z3 part and a Z4 part. The Z3 part is great. You know, it's this particular characteristic class. It cancels and it relies on a really nice fact. You know, there are 27 possible values for the anomaly on the Z-mod 27 Lens space generator. But the anomaly here is 1/3. It's not like 6 over 27, you know, something you might expect. If it were any of the other 26 possible values, this anomaly cancellation approach wouldn't work. So this is the kind of spooky magic that always happens in string theory. Like, you know, string theory really, it's really there. And so these like carefully set up things that seem to trap it, it just passes through them. So this was evidence to us that we were on the right track. Okay, and this is neat because the fermions, the eta invariants coming from the fermions, they do have larger denominators, but they sort of cancel each other out and we get to the only possible correct value. Finally, okay, at the prime two, then there's this Z4 term, which here things don't quite work so well. So we have the problem that we weren't able to determine the eta invariant on one of the generators. And this division by two thing is necessary, but it doesn't always make sense. You know, you can't divide by two in Z mod four. So on spin MP2 manifolds, this whole thing, like there's a way to make it work. There's a characteristic class that allows you to do this. On spin GL2 plus manifolds, we thought for a while and we weren't able to figure it out. And so we can in general only see the four times the anomaly cancel. So I'm confident that there's a way forward, but there's like more stuff to figure out. So in conclusion, first of all, sorry for going over time. There's details left to investigate, like, you know, the quadratic refinement on a spin GL2 plus manifold. And, you know, we still have some more generators that, you know, we don't know the anomalies of. But there's other stuff you can do that builds off this. So for example, there's a lot of checks on this anomaly cancellation, this extra term. You know, you should be able to see it in using like duality with M theory and saying, okay, well that would imply the following fact about M theory. Hey, is that true? Let's compute some stuff. Or by compactifying down to lower dimensions, does this reproduce things that we think are true? So there's plenty of stuff there that to do. And there's lots of other anomalies out there to calculate. So for example, I would like to try this with T and U duality. I'm currently stuck on the problem that I don't know the cohomology of the duality groups. So this is there's like lots more stuff to do. And so, you know, this, even though I have presented to you a paper that is out, the story really is to be continued. So thanks so much for your time. Sorry for going over time, and let me know if you have any questions.
All right, thanks. So are there any questions?
I already asked many.
You're welcome to ask more.
Yeah, definitely. Don't hold back.
Yeah, all of the questions so far have been great by everyone.
I did have one question very early on about just the general framework of these calculations.
Okay.
Not even of the calculations you did, the general framework and like the introductory sort of part of your talk. You had this sort of comment that I meant to ask you about at the time that was like, these anomaly calculations are something you can do just from the field content of theories. And I was wondering if you could
explain that. In that case, I should have said it was this thing.
It was slightly later. I forget. So the point was, your story went, if I understood your story, this is a beautiful story. Your story goes, it's not too bad to just figure out what the specific structure group we care about is. That's just something like, if I really know what type of theory I'm talking about, then I know what H is. Then you told us how to do these hard atoms calculations, or these sort of hard spectral sequence calculations. There it is. So then at the end of the day, you actually have to calculate the value of the anomaly.
Yes. Yes. And that's something that I totally skipped over. But
and why should it, is there why is this true? Why should it be something that is why do anomalies only depend on field content and not, is this a general principle that says that if I have a quantum field theory given by some fields?
I am definitely not confident enough to say that. So here's what I meant when I wrote this sentence, which is, you know, in principle, so before we do any Bordism computations, we know what fields we're considering in this. We have the C field, we have a bunch of fermions. And so if you have a fermion transforming in a particular representation of a group, then there is an anomaly to check, which is an eta invariant, right?
Right.
And then moreover, the C field is self-dual. And so there's this prescription for the anomaly of a self-dual field. And so based on how it transforms under this GL2 representation. And so what I meant by this was only that once you know, okay, I have fermions and they transform in this way under the symmetry, the anomaly is the following recipe. And then so you can compute that. I am definitely not trying to say something big here, because in my experience, when I make big sweeping statements about quantum field theory, they tend to be wrong.
Maybe David will explain.
Okay, sure. Go ahead if you want.
Yes. Hi. So suppose I do get the tree brain in type 2B, which supports U1 gauge theory.
Okay.
I assume that if I put it in this sort of Begrand and non-trivial F theory-like setup, that would mean that on this gauge theory has been coupled to the Begrand where electromagnetic duality can happen as you move around your manifold. As duality. Yes. So I remember that people have computed the anomaly for gauge theory to be self-dual. It was worked by McGreevy, I think, and others.
How do you spell the name of the people who did this?
McGreevy. Let me see. I should be able to.
You can also put it in chat, and I will see it there.
Yeah, I'm just very bad with names, so. Okay. Don't know if it's a correct paper, but it's okay. The name of the author, I think, is this. The paper I would have to find more carefully. And okay, I don't remember if they discussed the whole SL2 or only the Z2. But anyway, so I think it's true that there is an anomaly to putting a billion gauge theory on a manifold with an SL2 or GL2 structure. Mm-hmm. Presumably this anomaly is canceled in the type 2B setup by some kind of anomaly inflow mechanism where perhaps the Schoen-Simons term is found or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In the presence of the source given by the D3 brain, cancels this anomaly on the D3 brain. Mm-hmm. That might be useful check or a source of information. The anomaly of the gauge theory is computable because it's a free gauge theory.
Right.
A billion gauge theory.
Okay.
It might give some interesting constraint.
That's a good idea. Thank you. Yeah, the checks that we did were, I mean, we did some sort of heuristic M theory checks and looked a little bit at compactifications, but didn't go super far. So this is okay. This is good. I'm gonna look at that. Because that seems, yeah, you mentioned it seems computable, which is that's often the big obstacle for me is like, well, anyways, yeah, thank you.
A possibly related question might have to do with, in the holographic setup, when you have a look at situations like ADS5 times M5.
Yes.
Situation. Then I could imagine integrating these anomaly polynomials on the five-dimensional compact thing.
Yep.
And then getting something going on ADS5 that might perhaps say something about the boundary theory. So right. So I was talking about just the theory of 1D tree brain, but the tree brains in conical geometries might also have an alternative.
I know we spent a little time thinking about ADS5 cross S5, but I don't know. That might have sort of, I don't know whether that was like we did a check and just didn't put it in. Or I think what happened, like this was, my collaborators worked more on that side of it, but I think it was, that helped guide us to these formulas, like this Bachstein and this this other one.
Okay.
Wait, so, but you said you, okay, I want to make sure, was there a question in there? Because you said you had a question and I wasn't sure.
Well, I guess the question was if you had thought about probes, brain probes in this.
Ah, yeah. So we have not looked at brains in this, mostly at like M theory checks. So that does seem like a good thing to check.
Perhaps really, right. Another question I could have asked is, once you compactify the theory in a circle, say, then you get these larger u-duality groups.
Yes.
And so I guess there are generalizations of the statements you're making involving lower dimension but bigger groups.
Yes. Yeah, so this is actually something that we're sort of interested in doing this later, like as future work. So you know, you get SL2Z, SL3Z, SL, and, you know, the variants there, like MP3 or something. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is, what's the cohomology of these things? So GL2 plus, we have this nice amalgamation that we can do by hand. But like, so the sort of all the way down to dimension 4, and we have to do like the real form of the split form of E7 over the integers. And so it's like, this is some arithmetic group. Has anyone computed the cohomology of this? If anyone knows this, like, please let me know, because that would be really great. And similarly with T-duality, you know, it's O3, 3Z that we would want to use. And I think the number theorists think about these things, but I have no idea if they've computed that particular one or how. So that's sort of, that is like, even I guess SL3, SL4 would be a good next step. And that's something that would be, you know, the input cohomology is sort of where we got to start. So if your friends compute cohomology of arithmetic groups, you know, let me know what they know.
All right. Is everyone satisfied? All right. Thanks for the talk.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.